thanks for joining us for today's episode. But before we start the show, just a quick reminder that in addition to our podcast feed, we also sponsor events in physical places like live podcasts, panel discussions, and programs featuring art, music, film, and other such mediums. And we also host live events online where listeners are welcome to join in. Check out our website to see if we have any live events coming up to a place near you or any virtual events you can join in as well. Or maybe you have an idea for collaboration. Feel free to get in touch with us and share your thoughts. But for now, let's get into the show. For this episode of Inside Myanmar Podcast, we're pleased to be welcoming Toby Mindell, who is from the Center for Law and Democracy, which is located in Halifax, Nova Scotia. And Toby has been involved in Myanmar issues from 2012, going through the transition period, and then the sudden shift that all of us went through after the transition with the coup. So has a bit of institutional history through these emotional roller coasters that have followed Myanmar's recent history. So Toby, thank you for sitting down and joining us on this episode of Inside Myanmar Podcast.
Oh, great pleasure.
So let's learn a bit more about your background, as well as what exactly the Center for Law and Democracy does in general, and how it's been oriented towards Myanmar in particular.
Okay, so I'm a lawyer, and the Center for Law and Democracy, as you mentioned, is based in Nova Scotia, Canada. Not everybody knows that Nova Scotia is in Canada, and we're an international human rights organization. We focus on what we call the foundational rights for democracy, and we focus specifically on five rights: freedom of expression, the right to information, or FOIA, as it's called in the United States, freedom of association, freedom of assembly, and the right to participate. So they're basically that what we consider to be the pillars upon which democracy rests. As I mentioned, we started working on Myanmar in 2012, which was in the early part of when the international community kind of recognized that a transition was taking place. I mean, some people date the transition to earlier than that, but that was when the early days for the international community to start to engage, and we were in that early wave, basically.
Right, yeah. And so I have to ask you to kind of set the context as we go deeper into Myanmar, and I'm thinking also of a recent interview we did with the Secretary General of International IDEA, Kevin Casas-Zamora, where he mentioned the really concerning backsliding of democracy around the world, even in the so-called Western liberal democratic countries. And so just to set the context before we get into Myanmar, and I'm not sure if this might be somewhat outside of the scope of what you do or your organization does, in looking at recent years or even the last couple of decades, what are you seeing or what are your thoughts globally, not just in these countries that are trying to get out of certain authoritarian systems and get into democratic ones, but ones who have long been democracies that are now facing some sort of problems themselves. What are you seeing globally towards this, some of the trends taking places?
Yeah, so I mean, we certainly observe that globally. I think we need to be very careful not to generalize, and also not to place undue weight, or certainly not to generalize the situation in certain countries beyond what they actually represent. And I mean, you know, it's impossible not to mention the United States in this context. We've seen a huge threat to democracy with the re-election of Trump and the kind of some of the things that he's doing in the United States. That is of huge concern. The United States is, you know, a very, very important part of the established democratic world, and to see it backsliding is a great concern. But I think we need to be careful not to paint that beyond what it is. My own country, Canada, and I'm never complacent about democracy in any country, including my own, but I don't think we've seen a significant backsliding there. We've seen some fairly extreme right-wing movements in Europe, but so far none of them have actually won electoral success. So that's a concern, but it hasn't come to fruition yet. What I think is perhaps of more concern is, China over the past 10 years, for example, has become, China's never been a democracy, so I would not talk of backsliding in China, but China's become much more aggressive about exporting non-democracy to other countries. Obviously, China's a very powerful, important country with a lot of capacity to export anti-democratic values, and it didn't used to do that, going back before 10 years or Xi Jinping's time, and now it is. We've seen India has wobbled, the largest democracy in the world has wobbled, although I think the last election we affirmed democracy in India. Russia, obviously, its own democracy, never strong, has backslid, significantly, generally under Putin, but, much more dramatically so after the full-scale invasion of Ukraine. So, there are a lot of concerning developments around the world, but there are still, I think, it's not like it's happening everywhere. And there are some countries that are making progress. Malaysia, for example, is moving forward in terms of democracy. Mongolia, it's in a little bit of a difficult point right now, but, has been moving strongly. So I think we have to more subtle than just sort of everything's bad. But overall, certainly we're seeing a regression if you sort of average all the countries in the world. But underneath that, there's some serious backsliding in some places, but a lot of countries that are not backsliding and some that are making progress. So a rather complicated picture, I would say.
Yeah, thank you for that overview and getting a bit more nuanced in there. And I think I would also personally add, say Poland or South Korea as examples of where there has been some democratic pushback. And I think it's also interesting to look at this as we look at Myanmar's context. I think for those that are just looking at Myanmar's recent history, we look at the touchstone points that have happened in the last 70 years. But as part of Myanmar's history, but when we look at where those line up with global issues, for example, 48 independence, we could look at that as the post-World War II decolonization of many countries getting their freedom and their independence. Then later, 62, the coup, that's Cold War tensions. 88, famously, this was at a time when the Berlin Wall was falling down, the USSR, even South Africa. There just seemed to be this general overall freedom that was pushing forward in the world, the so-called end of history at the time. And Myanmar seemed like it was just getting in that caboose, and it just seemed like a lot of those other countries were able to jump over, and Myanmar was about to, and it just kind of got stuck. And now where we are here in post-21, now the Myanmar context finds itself in this kind of global trend and scare of at a time when rising authoritarianism and rising far-right groups, there does seem to be this this tension playing out between what democracy is and how much faith we have in this, and where authoritarian strongmen can come in and promise certain solutions. And and that's also why in this previous interview I mentioned, the guest used the phrase that Myanmar was on the front lines of democracy, and that's what we called the episode.
88, you're right, but then Myanmar didn't follow through with that, whereas, the Berlin Wall did fall down, Eastern and Central Europe did massively democratize, right? They went from being communist countries to flawed democracies like we all live in, but much, much stronger democracies. The end of one party, not the end, but a significant decline in one party states in Africa, the decline of military rule in Latin America. Those countries followed through with that at that time, and Myanmar didn't. So I wouldn't like to say that, Myanmar's floating along in the trends of history. And I would also say that, I forget the exact phrase you used about the previous speaker, the Myanmar on the front line of democracy. Was that the term? I don't accept that, because the democratic transition in Myanmar at every stage has been significantly flawed.
Yeah.
It never really bit down on democracy. For example, I would contrast what happened in Myanmar to what happened in Indonesia, again, going back to now 98. And in Indonesia, the military, which had ruled the country for a very long time, I think also since 1962, actually, tried to retain some power, did originally retain some power, some seats and some, you know, influence, but nothing like what the Myanmar military did with the transition in 2015, of course, much, much later, but also a much firmer grip. They retained three key ministries. Nothing like that happened in Indonesia. They had a constitutional veto. I mean, they really did not let go of the essential reins of power. So the transition, you know, unlike other countries, Myanmar never did a proper transition. And you know, we can see that. I mean, it was clear at the time for those of us that were looking more carefully. But now with the coup, you know, we can see that coming home to roost, as it were. So I think, you know, Myanmar never really made it.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to clarify a couple of points, in 88, I didn't mean to suggest that certainly Myanmar did not follow through as the other countries. But what was interesting was that not to go back into what actually happened, but to go back into the moment as it was happening. And I especially came on my radar when I read Mathita's book, Prisoner of Conscience, at the time, where she was, which is partly based on her diaries from being in prison and from being involved in the movement, and she's framing so much of what they're doing and what their aspirations are with global events that are happening at the time, and it was fascinating for me because it was I hadn't heard that kind of reflection or connection before, or synthesis. I had just heard the events in Myanmar and how they developed, and to think that this was happening simultaneously, and there was this feeling that it was moving in this direction. Of course, as I said, Myanmar was the one country that didn't. And looking at the transition, I think the guest wasn't referring to the faulty democracy of the transition period, but the aspired to democracy that is happening now. But this is all a good segue into that transition. And we've certainly had any number of guests who have referenced their concerns about how the transition was taking place and how some of those problems led to what we're seeing now. And so that's the question to pose to you. What work were you particularly doing during that transition? And what were some of your major concerns at the time?
Yes. So, I mean, for me, there have been sort of three recent transitions in Myanmar, the 2012 or 2010, if you will, pivot towards democracy, then the 2015 democratic election and the success of the NLD and Aung San Suu Kyi in particular, and then of course the coup in February of 21. And what I think is interesting, and what I mean from my point of view, working very, you know, at the coalface, we were working directly with senior government officials on democratic law reform, you know, particularly in the area of freedom of expression, and with some very, very important successes, which I can get into more detail with later if you're interested. But what we saw was a genuine interest in some very, very senior actors, the key people that we were working with during the military pivot towards democracy, to actually put in place democratic legislation and to put in place democratic structures and to move forward on that. And we achieved some very important legislative reforms, and we had in train a bunch more. It was a heady period of change, and real things were happening. Real, you know, things, laws were getting passed, good laws, and not perfect laws, but pretty good laws given the context. I mean, what I think probably many of your listeners may not fully understand or realize was that basically came to an abrupt halt with the election, Democratic election of the NLD. And I mean, we had seen some signs of that already, but we still had great aspirations for that period. You know, if we had achieved that much with these military guys, these unelected, basically, military guys, what was going to happen? You know, what was the potential when an actually democratically elected government with all of the hopes and aspirations of the people of Myanmar, which have always been very, very high and remain high, despite all of the problem, the enormous problems, with all of that, you know, wind in the sails, as it were, what was going to be possible? And I can say that we achieved almost nothing in terms of concrete legislative reforms over the five-year period of the first NLD government. Indeed, we didn't even see minor things. For example, in August of 2015, the previous government had adopted a very progressive broadcasting law, which put in place an independent broadcasting council to regulate broadcasting, like we see around the democratic world, which put in place very, very positive rules, aligned with international standards. That law was passed in August of 2015. It needed implementing legislation to be brought into force. That was adopted in October of 2020, just before the elections. In other words, nothing happened under that legislation for the whole of the period of the NLD rule. They blocked that legislation from being realized. The result of that was that at the time of the coup in February of 21, Myanmar had about 12 on-air radio stations, licensed radio stations, 12 in the whole country. I mean, apart from wildly repressive countries, there's no country in the world that looks like that. Even pretty repressive countries have far more radios than that. I mean, the sector just was absolutely not developed. The democratic broadcasting environment that this law envisaged, that the military guys that passed this law were envisaging, never happened. So, I mean, I think, that, and then, of course, the coup and everything went, fell off a cliff, basically. But I think it's important for your listeners to understand that, what we had hoped for and expected of the NLD government was simply not delivered.
That's absolutely fascinating and also tragic as well, and leaves open to so many questions. And I think just to set further context, one thing that's so interesting that's coming to my mind is that one of the typical narratives you hear about how the transition went down was that, okay, the NLD wasn't perfect, but they were trying under difficult conditions. And let's not forget that the military had this 25%, and there was always this danger. You talk to people in the NLD administration and supporting it, and they constantly mention what delicate kind of ice they were on, of feeling that if they did anything too far, that the military would come back. And so they're in this kind of tense standoff, and there's a limit to what they can do and what they can try to do. And then the Rohingya crisis happens. And then the Rohingya crisis is often what's portrayed as the cause for how everything falls apart. And the various reforms that were trying to get some progress at that time, that, the rug just got pulled out from under it with the Rohingya crisis. That's often a narrative that's heard. But you're telling a slightly different version of this, which is that from the two things there. First, from the time in 2015, before the Rohingya crisis has really reached its peak, from the very start of the NLD administration, you're not seeing the progress you did before. That's one part. And the second part is that you're actually contrasting your direct work with the Thein Sein administration and the NLD as they took power. And so you're having this contrast in play.
I certainly accept that the NLD operated under enormous constraints. They didn't control three key ministries, including interior, which is rather an important one for any government. And they did always have to negotiate with and, operate within the unwritten constraints, or perhaps more written constraints that we weren't seeing that writing because it was taking place behind closed doors, as it were, that were set by the military. I don't believe, however, that the things that I'm talking about were red lines for the military. I think it's an important point to make. The military, the previous government had also in February of 2016, so just before the NLD government took the reins of power, after the break between the election and that happening, had issued a draft right to information, freedom of information law. We engage with our partners in very intense and very imaginative, I would say, advocacy around that, trying to, break down any barriers to it and things, including working with the military guys to convince them that they didn't have to worry about this legislation because it wasn't going to open up any military secrets or anything. And I think we were somewhat successful in that. That did not progress at all either, and I don't believe it was because the military were essentially blocking it. So there were areas where the government was highly constrained, no doubt, and obviously so because of the military, but I don't think in our area that was the case. So coming back to your question, why? And this is may sound a little controversial, but I don't think that the sort of the blood running in the veins of the NLD, including its leader, really were committed to those democratic values. I don't think they were enthusiastic about having a free and open media which could criticize them. I don't think they were that willing to tolerate the criticism that is inherent in democratic governance. I think they had some pretty serious, psychological or attitudinal barriers to accepting a proper democracy. And I think that those were really the more important factors in at least that freedom of expression, access to information space, not so much the military. And I would also, you sort of said the Rohingya crisis happened. I mean, it didn't just happen, right? I mean, it was manufactured. I'm pretty confident when I speak about the areas that we were working on intensively, broadcasting, right to information, other freedom of expression issues. I'm being a little bit more speculative here, but Aung San Suu Kyi held enormous moral authority with the people. She could, strong political leaders, when they need to, they impact the thinking of the people. They change it in democratic ways. They help their people move in the way that they need to be a democracy, to be a successful country, to do those things. And the history of many of all of our democratic countries are replete with examples of that. Kennedy, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. Values like that, instilling values in the people. When the Rohingya crisis happened, what I saw was that Aung San Suu Kyi did not use any of that moral authority to try to shift attitudes. None of that happened. She just went along with it. Of course, there were issues with the military. There may be things there that I'm not seeing. What I saw from her was a utterly unimpressive display of simply, not showing any leadership at all, not combating what was, a very dramatic human tragedy, and not using her moral and political authority to combat that. That is a significant failure as a leader. And I think, and it's only with the coup, there unfortunately a lot of Bamar, especially Burmese people, have complicated feelings and views on the Rohingya crisis, most of which were, very out of line with the way that the international community was looking at it, and frankly, which I think the only democratic way to look at it. And we have seen a big shift in those attitudes since the coup, as ordinary Bamar people are seeing what it's like to face a hostile military themselves and realizing, this was what the Rohingya were dealing with. Now we're all dealing with it. And I've seen a huge shift in the thinking and values around that. None of that happened under the NLD government. There may have been red lines for her on that, but I think she could have done something and she didn't really do anything. So that to me is probably the most significant failure of her whole period.
Those are really powerful words, and I think they also just underscore the appreciation that we need to have. And by we, I mean, well, you and I and those listeners that were born and brought up and for your societies, and where we don't so much have an appreciation or a sympathy of what it's like growing up with certain kind of inherent conditioning that you don't just have to, it's not enough to just fix the outside system. The outside system has also oppress your internal systems and mechanisms that also need that change. And I see that present even through today, where with our podcast, just to speak personally, with our podcast platform, we speak to a lot of informed actors and encourage them to open up, as you've just done, with their informed views, knowing and recognizing they are subjective views. They are subjective views informed by direct experience. Sometimes, as with you, what you just said about Aung San Suu Kyi, sometimes they strike a nerve among some listeners, and to me, that's also fine and part of the process. I really welcome listener feedback and criticism of what I say, of what a guest says, of a challenging information. We all have a space to learn. And so where there is some pushback or criticism that comes after an episode, I really welcome it. But what I find happens all too often with some of our, with our audience in the country and maybe some diaspora, is that there can be a response of not engaging with the opinion that was said, but rather trying to shut it down, rather trying to have a response of either self-imposed censorship, that these comments need to be removed and that our platform is, you know, needs to be canceled or is toxic in some way, because this should not be allowed to share because it's an opinion different from what they personally believe, or just very disparaging, kind of out of line, inappropriate remarks, attacking the guest or some other such thing, rather than an engagement, you know, with those details. And if you have launched a criticism of Aung San Suu Kyi based on your experience at that time, which is fair game, it is also fair for someone to say, no, that's wrong because she was doing this and there was this factor and you done, and then we can have an agreement, or we can have a discussion. We don't need to agree, but we can understand that there's these different views and we all walk away better for the outcome of having this exchange of opinion. But when that kind of inner censor starts to take over, that I don't like what's being said, so therefore it should not be said, or therefore I should do something to punish the messenger or to punish the person who's saying it, that's when these kind of oppressive outside systems become oppressive inside systems that also need change. And so that's a kind of setup for, as you said, you came to understand or to feel that the National League for Democracy was actually not all that committed to democratic values.
A lot of what you were talking about there is what I would call the culture of democracy, which, you know, understands that we tolerate and we debate with ideas that we don't agree with or don't like, rather than trying to close them down and stop debate and things like that. I mentioned that I'm a lawyer, and so we were doing a lot of work with lawyers in Myanmar. Myanmar obviously being or having been a British colony, so sort of part of the wider English-speaking common law world. Not always, but what I often find in that large world, many, many countries and a lot, you know, significant part of the whole population of the world covered by it, is that even lawyers who have never themselves lived in a democratic dispensation still have a reasonably good understanding of, you know, what democracy means, let's say specifically in terms of freedom of expression, a key underpinning of democracy. You know, they understand the point you just made about tolerating things. They understand that, you know, there's a space for defamation laws, but they should not, inhibit open political debate, even highly critical debate. They understand that, you know, broadcasting needs to be regulated in a democratic way. Maybe they're not aware of all of the particular details of that, but they have at least a conception of that. And what was interesting for me when I first started working in Myanmar was that, let's say, residual, you know, democratic hangover, if that's the right way to put it, that's not a mixed metaphor, or democratic, you know, value understanding was not very strong at all in Myanmar. And, you know, the lawyers that we were working with, you know, I go to Uganda or, you know, African countries where, you know, which had never had a democracy or were just starting to build a democracy or something like that. But still that understanding would be, you know, reasonably present and not hard to, you know, G up, as it were, in terms of technical details and deeper understanding. That was missing in Myanmar. So, you know, the kind of the values that you're talking about, very specifically, let's say, in the legal community. I mean, Myanmar was coming from a fairly difficult place in terms of the level of understanding of democratic values as compared to, I would say, most former British colonies, which was a little bit of a surprise. And one of the things we did specifically to assist with the legal community is we created the Myanmar Media Lawyers Network. So a specific organization that networked lawyers that were committed to building a democratic media environment for Myanmar. And we did a lot of capacity building with those lawyers. And then we supported them to engage as a civil society organization in law reform efforts, for example, and that kind of thing. And actually, we have taken that model and we've started spreading it around the world, because actually those kinds of networks don't exist. There's one in the United States, there's one in Canada, there's one in Britain, there's one in Australia. But apart from that, there really are very few, before we started spreading it, very few around the world. And now we have, you know, we've built about 10 or 15 of them. So I think that the culture, the democratic culture piece was more challenging in Myanmar than a little bit like East and Central Europe, I would say, and not what I had sort of been assuming I would find in a former British colony. I don't know if that makes any sense. I want to just sort of maybe temper my criticism of the NLD a little bit. I don't think that they were not committed to democracy as a value. I think that they were not prepared to take on some of the attributes of democracy, including this idea of a free media, which would criticize leaders and things like that. I think there were, you know, some important barriers within their framework on democracy. I think that they were, more positively, and what they were committed to, which was your question. I think they were committed to advancing the social progress of the country, to, you know, having a more egalitarian social and economic environment. And I think they achieved some things in that area. One of the key partners that we were working with was a women's health organization, actually. We were working with them on the right to information because they were forward-looking enough to understand that for women's rights to be fully realized, governments needed to be open, and then they needed to kind of work on that piece as well, not their main work. They experienced quite a lot of success in their, you know, women's health and women's equality issues, for example. So there were some positive, you know, certainly some positive things happening over that period. But the advancement of the core value, building block values of democracy, did not, from my point of view, happen or not happen much, which I won't say that enabled the coup, because I don't think that would be fair. But I think that the tough long-term project of building a deep culture of democracy, which is, you know, what is really needed to maintain democracy, I don't think that was much advanced over the NLD period.
And certainly, and I agree with you, I don't think in any way it's fair to say it enabled the coup. The Min Aung Hlaing enabled the coup. Let's be really clear about that. However, I do think there could be something there that there could have been any number of ways that the NLD and Aung San Suu Kyi could have engaged during that period, which would have set up certain mechanisms, democratic thinking institutions, so that it could raise the barriers of enacting a coup more difficult, or if a coup then happened, some of those institutions would have a bit more momentum. But that's neither here nor there, because we only know what actually happened.
Well, the military guys ran the coup. The military guys, even though, as I mentioned, during the 2012 to 2015, you know, they did progress democracy in very real and very, important ways, but I also believe that they never actually thought they were giving up power for that long. They understood that they would, because we worked quite a lot with these guys from during that period, and I won't say I got a, you know, intimate insight into their thinking, but I did get some of that. And I mean, I think they understood that the NLD was going to win the 2015 election. I'm not sure that in 2015 they thought that that would carry on for a second election. I think rather they thought the NLD would screw everything up and that the people weren't that committed to them and that they would turn against them. And when the NLD won the second election, you know, again by a landslide, that was too much for them, and that was their own issue. And I'm not sure. I mean, I think that, you know, the NLD should have done more to build democracy. Perhaps that would have had some, you know, force against this military onslaught on democracy, if you will. Probably not enough to really stop it, but it still should have been done. That's just what democratic leaders do. You know, regardless, I mean, nobody would have predicted that the military were going to, you know, perpetrate a coup on February 1st, 2021. I think maybe by January, some people were starting to see the writing, but not much before then. But that doesn't, you know, democratic leaders are supposed to build democracy. That's what they're supposed to do.
You did have interaction with any number of people in the Thein Sein administration in working on progress that you were seeing with democratic reforms. And there has been a lot written and a lot spoken trying to analyze, what does this military really want? What do they want now? What have they wanted over the years? What are they, to what degree what they say they want is aligned with what they're actually doing?
So I want to be a little bit careful here, because I certainly don't want to paint myself as a psychological expert on the military government or anything like that. And the people I was meeting with, although they were quite senior, were mainly within the sphere of work that I was engaged with, so Ministry of Information and the MRTV and, you know, some of those kinds of, you know, institutions, and certainly not on the, say, still military side. Like, I never met anybody still in active military. They were all military people, but they weren't playing military roles, for example. I mean, from the people I was working with, by the way, some of whom are now in jail because they were committed to the democratic project. And when the coup happened, they essentially rejected that, and rejected it strongly enough that they were still saying enough things that even though they had been senior military people, the regime would not tolerate it and eventually put them in prison. So that's significant. And again, may show that the people that I was interacting with were not, you know, in line with the mainstream of the military. But I mean, I saw a real commitment to move things forward. That's slightly different from the long-term, you know, relinquishing of power. Because I think that they thought that under a democratic dispensation, I think they thought they were better for the country and that the people would see and understand that and that they would win elections democratically. So, you know, which, of course, was a total mind block on their part, which is not an uncommon thing to see in sort of, you know, dictatorial forces. They sometimes misunderstand reality because they're in their little glass chambers and whatever. But they did, you know, and I can remember, for example, over that period, that the Minister of Information emailing me and saying, you know, people are saying this, that this is the democratic way to do it, that I don't, that doesn't seem right to me. You know, please tell me what the real thing is. And I mean, which I thought was remarkable. I've spent 30 years working in this area. I don't think I've ever received an email from a Minister of Information along, you know, say, with that kind of plea, please tell me whatever you say, I'm going to do it kind of thing. And sometimes he was wrong and sometimes he was right. And what the, you know, what the media and other actors were saying was not correct, and that, you know, they were overstating or interpreting to their own advantage what human rights meant, and that they were incorrect. And so, you know, I mean, that to me showed you know, so someone that really did want to do something properly and was referring to me as an authority on that. And I was impressed with that. As I mentioned, I mean, the broadcasting law that these guys did adopt, I mean, you know, that's a real thing, right? They adopted a law, not just talking or positioning, but is one of the strongest broadcasting laws in Asia in terms of alignment with international human rights standards. And I work very closely with them on that, and they were very receptive to the inputs I was providing, and a lot of other people provided inputs as well, from international experts on democratic broadcasting legislation, and they largely took those things on board. They had filed a public service media law in Parliament. They later withdrew it because there were some controversies that we don't need to get into, but again, it was very strong and very progressive. Their real actions in terms of what they did, it's very difficult to square that with what happened with the coup. And of course, the, extreme brutality and intransigence. And I mean, struggling to find the right words that you could say on radio for to describe them. They are one of the worst regimes in the world today, for what they're doing. It's hard to kind of line that up with these things that were happening, but those things were happening. It did happen. Honestly, as a longstanding human rights activist, it was a heady time. We were doing great things, and it was exciting to be working in the country and seeing these things getting pushed through.
And so then with the 2021 coup, now we're entering the third phase of our discussion, going from Thein Sein to NLD Aung San Suu Kyi to post-military coup. How has your work shifted, and what are you now doing?
Yeah, so, until the coup, we were focused on building democracy. We were having a lot of success in the first period, in the second period, less so, but still, we were building institutions like the MMLN, the Lawyers Network. We were doing a lot of awareness raising with civil society. We were doing a lot of advocacy around law reform. I mean, we were building democracy. Obviously, all of that became completely impossible after the coup. So we pivoted to a few things. Firstly, we sort of bore witness to the bad things that the regime was doing. So I won't say every time, but more or less every piece of legislation or amendment that the regime adopted, we analyzed it from a human rights point of view. Everybody knew that these enactments were hostile to democracy, but our analysis helped them understand exactly how they were human rights misaligned or abusive. We also started working on what I would call the sort of the Future Democracy in Myanmar project, which, it's matured and developed in its conceptualization over time. But from the very beginning, it was about, helping to build a free and independent media now. So one foot in, one foot out, as they say, but institutionally outside of the country, helping to maintain and develop civil society organizations that understood freedom of expression and the other democratic rights we work on, and that could, start to build that culture out and things. So working with other civil society organizations that were engaging on these issues. So that was a big part of the project in the early days. And now, as little governing or as entities which are controlling territory and governing territory outside of the remit of the regime are starting to develop and are basically little statelets, we have started to engage with them to try to ensure that as far as possible they are behaving in democratic ways so that the culture of democracy, which, as I mentioned before, was a significant missing element in the whole Myanmar democratic project, would start to be built as best as possible. So that's roughly what we're doing.
And as we talk about the conceptions of democracy, the kind of a mature understanding of it, as well as wading through past conditionings, are you, because you're able to contrast these three different eras, and it's hard to answer this comprehensively because it's more theoretical. It's not actually put in place because there's such limited opportunity there, even in the so-called liberated areas, given the kind of devastation, conflict that's currently going on. But just speaking from a term of sitting down and talking to people and learning about their aspirations and what they're working on, how they're thinking, how they're conceptualizing, do you see or feel a difference in terms of how people are holding these concepts and the work that they want to do versus those other two periods?
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the silver linings of the coup is that it has actually progressed thinking on democracy quite significantly in Myanmar. For example, you know, it was broadly, I mean, nobody in the communities that we were working with was excited about the roles that the powers that the military had, you know, reserved to themselves after 2015. But now that is an absolute red line. There will not be a future Myanmar with the military holding those kinds of powers, which of course is perfectly correct. And the situation between 2015 and 2020 was highly anomalous and unlike in any other quote unquote democracy in the world. But that, you know, that thinking, for example, has advanced. You mentioned that the one point that, you know, people may criticize this podcast, and of course I welcome constructive criticism and engaged criticism, even if it's harsh. But I have to say that, for example, when I talk about the NLD period, as I have done on this podcast with the people we're interacting with, which of course is a very, very, it's not the average, Myanmar person by any means. They're activists who are outside of the country. But still, I think that way of thinking has really advanced. I think that, key issues like the patriarchy, I think there's been a significant move on that. And Myanmar was a very, very patriarchal society. And I think that, I mean, and not to say that it's going to shed that immediately, but I do think the coup has helped boost it along on that. I think the whole positioning vis-a-vis the Rohingya, I can tell you that a lot of even the very progressive groups that we were working with took a position on the Rohingya, which was very, very different from the position that I take and that the international community takes during the NLD period. Thinking on that has utterly transformed in the groups I'm working with. So I think, somehow this thing has boosted democratic understanding quite significantly. And that's a positive and a hopeful sign. And I would also say, I mean, it's not quite what you asked, but I am enormously impressed by the strength of resistance of the people of Myanmar. In the face of untold opposition, they are standing up and being counted and continuing to do that, even while, the rest of us are not, giving them the support that they need and deserve, not as much as they need and deserve, certainly. It's really impressive. And I think that also is a very, very hopeful note for the future of Myanmar. And they're asking for everything, and they should have everything in terms of democracy and human rights, just as everyone should have it. So, that's a very positive thing that I'm seeing.
And to continue our contrast, we looked at the Thein Sein administration, or at least those elements you worked with, those elements that you worked with in with Aung San Suu Kyi's NLD administration, and then some of those activists and groups you're working with post-coup. Have you in any way been involved with any aspects of the NUG or the other body, CRPH or NUCC, just standing back, being able to look at the processes that they're setting up and the work that they're doing? And if so, what would be your evaluation as to how committed they are, again, to your words, to democratic values and building democratic institutions?
Yes, so we have been somewhat engaged with some of those actors that you mentioned. I have to be a little bit careful here because this is quite sensitive work, as you can imagine. So I don't want to kind of lay it out too openly, even though I'm very committed to openness. But sometimes you have to be a little bit careful. I mean, I think that there are elements within the oppositional forces to the military, to paint it broadly, that are very committed to democracy. There are, as I mentioned, I mean, I think there's sort of the civil society, media, the kind of, the broad notion of civil society, including media, academics, and all of that, which, with the broadest conception of civil society incorporates all of that. I think there is a very strong commitment to democracy. So at the grassroots level, which I think was probably not that strong before. So I think that's an added plus for sure. But there are also, I would absolutely, counsel anyone not to look at it as, the good guys and the bad guys. The military is so bad, and it's one of the most repressive regimes in the world, as I've said. Anyone looks good compared to them. If you're not out there committing atrocity crimes on a daily basis, you're better than those guys because that's what they're doing. But we shouldn't allow that fact so that, everyone's better than them. But it doesn't mean that everyone's good, and good being defined as committed to democracy and human rights and other positive social values like, mostly encompassed within that. There's a big range within the oppositional forces. Some are more committed and some are less committed. And I think that, people of Myanmar and the international community as well need to be very clear on that, need to understand that, replacing the military with something that's less toxic than them is not what Myanmar needs. What Myanmar needs, and which every country deserves, is a proper functioning democracy. It's after going through all of this suffering, to put up with something that's just better than that would be an utter failure in my view. Some of the actors in that space are closer to just a bit better than that than the positive vision of democracy that the people I'm working with hold. So, I think we need to be very aware of that and conscious of that, and to make sure that we are rejecting, limited conceptions of democracy, even among groups that we support for opposing the regime. That's not enough for us to accept, the stance they're taking on democracy. They need to reform themselves and become democratic as well as opposing the regime. And we need to sort of fight for that everywhere and in every single part of the country.
And then what about the ethnic revolutionary organizations? To what degree have you worked with them or learned about what they're doing?
Yeah, I mean, I think everybody is committed to a federal arrangement. That is, there's A to Z on federalism. It's not like there's sort of unitary states and federal states and that's it. I mean, whole massive range of options in terms of federalism. I think that people probably have very, very different conceptions about what that means, how much autonomy different parts of the federation might have, whether it's more of a confederal arrangement or a proper federation, and so on and so forth. I think that that's a very, very big debate and discussion that Myanmar needs to have at some point. And I think that the de facto emergence of governing territories that have emerged through the military struggle and are based on military successes, I think it's a big risk for Myanmar that dictates the nature of federalism rather than a democratic debate about what a federation, what proper federal arrangements should pertain to Myanmar. So sort of facts on the ground that got there in opposition to a vile military regime should not dictate the future of the country. Rather, that should be done in a democratic manner. And I think that it's going to be hard to stop those facts on the ground from dictating to some extent, or at least significantly influencing. So I think that's a big challenge. We have We have largely been engaging in a reactive way with the different provisional governments. So they adopt the policy and we analyze it. And, you know, those policies are public and our analyses are sometimes public and sometimes we hold them back for so we can have open discussions with them. And I think that we're realizing that, you know, while that was okay at the front end and when we are kind of at the front end, we're going to be much more proactive as we go forward. So what we are, resources permitting, because we also have to, get funding for our work. But what we're hoping to do is to, build out a basic democratic framework of laws and practices that any governing territory, whether it's ethnic or not, in any entity which controls territory in which it's governing, should put in place that take into account the military situation, because these entities are fighting basically for their territory every day, so they're not normal entities, not like a proper country which doesn't have to fight for its borders all the time. That changes things. That makes, that allows for the legitimate restriction on rights that would not be legitimate outside of that context. You can't have journalists reporting on what's happening on the front lines if it exposes you militarily, for example. That's not an issue that my own country, Canada, has to deal with, for example. So putting in place, and also they're very basic. They don't have a lot of resources. They don't have a lot of capacity. So we need to adapt. Democrat, we're not talking about an all singing, all dancing democracy at this stage. But our idea now is to put in place a basic framework for democracy and then go out and, instead of sort of when they adopt something, reacting to it, say, okay, this is what you need. If you're interested in this, we'll help you adapt it to your circumstances or whatever. And if you're not interested in it, maybe we will criticize you, or maybe we will, encourage local actors or support local actors to use that as a basis for criticism or at least engagement or advocacy and things. So, getting more substantially and systemically involved in the democracy building project, that would be our goal going forward. Because I mean, these entities are, they're there. I was going to say they're increasing in size. I mean, there's ebbs and flows on that. But we believe that they will be there for the foreseeable future until something happens with the rump part of, with the military regime falls at some point, or I don't know what will happen. I don't have a crystal ball for that. But we want to solidify democracy in all of these areas as far as possible. And so being proactive about it as opposed to reactive is the way we're looking at it going forward.
Right. And you just mentioned how your work is really predicated on how things actually go with the conflict. This is depending on how this conflict ebbs and flows and where it ends up, how messy it gets, how much there's room to do things. That's really dependent on the work that you'll go in. And we have no idea really not only how long that will take, but also what kind of context or field or country we're even looking at, which then these institutions will have to adapt to what that reality is. So we don't know about that. But one thing that we can talk about is, once there is some space to start to do more, and whenever that is and however that takes, that some of the work...
Which there already is.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. And we have done episodes exploring some of the local public governance that has taken place. And that's, it's an incredible development that's happened. And I think something the international community has not been so attuned to. But which actually, I'm glad you bookmarked that, because I do want to come back to that. But getting to the question now that I was building towards this, once there does become a greater context in which somehow, some way to be able to have these actors move in and start to really be able to move forward in terms of what you're looking at, what are you looking towards? What are your hopes and your aspirations, and what are your challenges and concerns based on what you're seeing in this coup and resistance period?
Right. So, I mean, we would like to see arrangements in these entities, for lack of a better word, that, allow civil society to operate as freely as possible, taking into account the military situation, which, of course, is real. And as we have moved forward in providing advice, we have looked around the world for better practice, military arrangements and military policies, for example, from the U.S. government, from the Canadian government, from the government of Ukraine, from the government of Israel, you know, countries which are very engaged in military issues who, you know, have honed their policies in real world situations, so that the policies are real, but they still reflect democracy and things. And we've incorporated those standards and approaches into our advice to these entities. But basically that, you know, allow civil society to operate freely, so respect freedom of association, which allow media outlets again to operate freely, potentially in the context of a registration or even licensing framework, but one that doesn't unduly constrict the ability to operate media. So there's been some pushing and pulling around that, and that, you know, tolerate criticism. Criticism does not undermine your ability to operate militarily, right? Identifying where your troops are in a battle. That's a little sensitive, but criticizing the military on something, you know, whether it's a social issue or even a military issue, unless it's exposing military secrets, but otherwise, so that is essentially, and these would be basic kinds of arrangements. So we're not expecting a fully fledged NGO law that has all of the trappings of everything, you know, dealing with all of the issues and things like that. But, you know, basic respect for these kinds of democracy building things. And of course, should more formal democratic mechanisms like elections take place, which I haven't heard of yet, but in that case, we encourage that and probably call for that when it's possible. And of course, those should take place properly and all that kind of stuff. And when I say elections, I mean in the liberated areas, not in the country as a whole. It's not possible to have a free and fair election in Myanmar today.
I want to come back to just that point about where it's already happening now, which is what these stories are really some of the most incredible and most inspiring. So can you tell us, and again, through safety filters, I think there's a way to talk about these things in a general sense, which gives the information, which inspires and informs all of us without saying exactly who's doing it, where it's happening, how it's happening, that exposes them to risk. So with those safety filters in place, what can you tell us about some of these local initiatives that are already happening and underway?
Yes. Yeah, so, I mean, a few of the entities have adopted, for example, media policies. So we've been engaging with them on that. A couple have adopted, rules on registration of civil society groups and things like that. So we've been engaging with them on that and things. So, I mean, it's those kind of, and, you know, they're basic policies. I would say that, you know, even where, And the intentions, as I said before, different groups are more or less democratically oriented. And I think that's a reality that we have to deal with, and that will always be there. And that's true around the world as well. But even when the democratic intentions are fairly strong, the lack of, sophisticated knowledge and understanding of democracy and, how to accommodate, real military needs while not unduly constricting rights. Otherwise, it's a steep learning curve, so we're engaging at that level very much.
Right. So then, going back to the start of our conversation, where we looked at the global circumstances and trends where Myanmar finds itself in, and then as we went into the details and contours of Myanmar's history and your engagement the last 15 years or so, but looping back to that global story and issue, and also looping back to you being from Canada and you mentioning that Canada, in your view, is although maybe no perfect democracy, you're pretty satisfied with its stability and with how it's going. And so, with the U.S. now under Trump formally wanting to distance itself from any kind of support towards democracy or human rights or other such initiatives around the world, a role that it's traditionally played in a strong form, what hope do you have for Canada taking a step beyond its own democracy and starting to do more to fill in those gaps and help some of these initiatives around the world?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very interesting question. Obviously, when a major player steps out of a important space, so the democracy promotion space, as the U.S. has done with the cancellation of U.S. foreign assistance, essentially, then that leaves a lot of space for other actors to come in. I think before I respond on Canada, I think we have to be very aware that China, a very powerful country with a lot of resources and a lot of ambitions in the international sphere. I mentioned earlier, I think that, you know, China has gotten a lot more aggressive about exporting non-democracy. You know, that didn't happen previously with China, but it certainly is happening now. And we have to assume that they will, you know, in a very engaged and powerful way, far more than Canada could ever do, step in on the wrong side of the equation to undermine democracy and to build non-democracy and non-democratic values. So, I mean, I think that's the biggest risk from the American withdrawal from this space. I mean, I certainly hope Canada is growing significantly in size and with the economic implications that brings. And I think that this may be considered a little bit controversial, but I don't think that our international attitudinal outlook has grown with our size as fast as it should, or hasn't quite kept up. And I think that especially the current government is sort of leapfrogging us to where we should be in that. So I think, and the previous government to some extent, but I think this government has, you know, pretty mature and, solid ideas about the proper place of Canada in the world, which is a bigger place and a bigger role than it had been playing. And with the U.S. withdrawal, that kind of allows that to develop, I suppose, in some positive ways. I certainly hope that Canada engages more heavily specifically on democracy and human rights. Those are obviously core Canadian values, very much valued in Canada, at the grassroots level, but also at the governmental level. A lot of our aid program hasn't been as heavily oriented in that area as I at least would like to see it, and I hope that it pivots more to that. I think that's, building schools and building wells and whatever, it's all important, but building the foundations of democracy really, and in the current global environment, those things are very much, as we talked about before, under attack in a lot of ways and backsliding and things. So that means that they need more support. In the specific context of Myanmar, where Canada has been playing an important role, but could play a bigger role, I think that overall, the international community, from the early days, from 2012 and following, there was a lot of money. Myanmar was a donor darling for a longer period than most countries get to hold that position. But before the coup and certainly before the U.S. withdrawal, there had been a significant downgrading of all of that. This is not the time to downgrade Myanmar in terms of attention from the international community. The democracy building project in Myanmar is absolutely essential now, even if we don't have a clear way to a future democratic Myanmar, like in the whole country. But, it takes a while to build democracy, and, you can't wait until the regime falls to do that. So I really hope that Canada and others, step in or increase their commitment to that. But I think that Canada is, come back to your question. I mean, I think there is an opportunity for Canada, and I think that Canada is, is oriented towards that at this time. We'll have to see. It's very, very early days of the new government, as you know. It just took place in the election was just in March, I think. So.
Just a final question as we wrap up and look at and take advantage of your work and perspective being so developed and ingrained in this kind of democracy mindset and looking at what it takes to build things up and how easily they slip away and kind of staying with the focus in Canada And wondering if to what degree there's a tension or concern with not just the Democratic backsliding happening with its next door neighbor that's been, United States has been, as we know, one of the biggest supporters of Democratic ideals for so many decades. Not only has it been backsliding in that direction, but it's also had, Trump has had some pretty aggressive statements towards Canada, to say the least. And one never knows how serious he is and how much these are just kind of like WWF, feints to draw attention and say something crazy, but, suggested, shockingly, an expansionist policy towards Canada.
I can't psychoanalyze President Trump any more than anyone else, and I don't think anybody really has a handle on that guy. When Putin invaded undertook the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, I think he thought it would be over in a matter of weeks. I think he thought that the Ukrainians would, throw flowers at the invading troops and welcome them in as liberators from their oppressive government. He was slightly misled in his thinking. And here we are today, still in the midst of a bloody battle over there. I wonder whether a similar kind of thinking process might not have been inside of President Trump's head, when he talked about the 51st state, and he made pretty explicit threats. He said probably not when it came to the military side of things, which is remarkable. But he certainly talked about that the economic pressures would force Canada, which is, highly aggressive language. But I wonder whether he also said, how great it would be if Canada joined the United States and all the wonderful things that would happen and how much, richer we would be and all that kind of stuff. I wonder whether he, like Putin, wasn't just completely, or was just throwing out random things to see what kind of a bite he got on that. Of course, Canadians, like anyone else, don't want to sacrifice their independence and their country and all that kind of stuff. If he was thinking about that, he was, completely mistaken. In fact, he has sort of galvanized Canadians in a way that I have never seen the country being galvanized. You see more Canadian flags in Quebec, the French separatist province, than you would ever have before. It's reminded Canadians of what is good about Canada and why we love to be Canadians and what we're proud about our country, without saying everything's wonderful, because it's certainly not. But still, it really, really galvanized Canadians in a way that I have never seen in my whole life. So that's kind of interesting. I think people are, the economic stuff continues. The threats and the posturing and whatever, it's very, very destabilizing. It does, it does make people nervous. Our biggest partner by far is the United States. We are highly dependent on our trade relationship with the United States. I think a lot of Canadians believe that over time we can pivot to other countries, and we will do that, and we are doing that, but that's not something you can't snap your fingers and shift your whole trading pattern and things. So I think there is, there's concern about the economic impact of things, but there's also absolute determination that whatever that might bring, we will bear it and work on it and move past it, and not, be subjected to thing. And that would never, ever work anyway. I think that, the same threats and pressures and challenges that every country faces in this, information challenged world. And when I say information challenged, I mean the reliability of information, the spread of disinformation, the ability of people to be completely confused about what's really going on, which is dramatic and threatening to democracy. Canada faces that just as much as any other country. Even though I think we have, this is going to sound controversial, but I think we actually have a much stronger media environment than the United States does. We have a strong public broadcaster. We have other elements. We have a pretty diverse, generally not that highly politicized or partisan media environment, and all of those things are strengths. In comparison to the United States, which I think the partisan nature of the media and the lack of a public broadcast and things that, have not helped the political environment down there. But still, you know, we have people who are confused about reality and what's going on and all that kind of stuff. I think we also have very strong institutions. Our Supreme Court is independent in a way that the U.S. Supreme Court isn't. And I don't mean sort of formally independent. I mean politically independent, right? You know, everybody talks about 6 Republican judges and 3, Democratic judges on the U.S. Supreme Court. Nobody talks about the political orientations of the, you know, justices on the Supreme Court of Canada because they don't have one. You know, it's not like that. And so, I mean, I think that, you know, we have strengths, but we also, you know, we need to be vigilant in defending our democracy. You know, it's as the information space becomes more and more challenged, which you know, with AI and things, I think will continue. We all need to be very vigilant about that. But for now, I think, you know, Canada's looks fairly, you know, compared to other countries, looks in fairly good shape, and certainly compared to our southern neighbor.
Well, I thank you so much for your time and joining us to go over your background and overview of your Myanmar work.
Well, I just, again, to reiterate, I mean, I think that coming back to Myanmar, the core focus of our discussion, you know, Myanmar is in, the people of Myanmar are engaged in an epic struggle for their country, for its, you know, very survival to some extent, and certainly for its progress in terms of democracy and human rights. Not to say that they're not getting any support from the democracies of the world, but they need more support. They also need more pressure being directed at those countries which are not democratic and which are not supporting the democratic process, and Russia and China being the big players there. I think, you know, the world, Myanmar is not in the limelight anymore. You know, with all of the other things that are going on, you don't see a lot of reporting on Myanmar anymore in the Western media. Despite that, I think it's absolutely incumbent on Western governments to really, you know, support the democratic movement in Myanmar and hope that in the end, I don't have a crystal ball, but hopefully in the end it'll come out okay, and it will be a democracy.
Many of you know that in addition to running the Insight Myanmar podcast platform, we also administer a nonprofit, Better Burma, to respond to the terror that the Burmese military has been inflicting on the country and its people. We encourage listeners to check out our website's regularly updated humanitarian blog to see the work that Better Burma has been carrying out, along with the upcoming projects we are hoping to support. Right now, as I'm sure you all know, and today's interview only reinforced, that need is still overwhelming. Your donations go directly to supporting vulnerable communities who need it most, and any donation, regardless of size, is so greatly appreciated. Check out insightmyanmar.org/donation to learn how to give.
Yarananda, Yananga, Yarananga, 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 Yarananga,